In the news.
Welcome to In the News, week three. I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Thank you for joining us.
We've got a couple topics we wanted to cover, and we thought we would start with what seems to be the issue that's dominating the headlines, and that's immigration. So just to set the table real briefly, immigration, border security, immigration reform has been on the table for a long time. Professor McDaniel, how many undocumented people are there in the United States today? I want to say like 11 million, but I might be making that figure up or being incorrect about that figure.
It might be less, but and the problem with the undocumented is that there are some people who enter illegally, and there are some people who have a visa and overstay their visa, and so you have this problem of did you enter illegally or did you come in illegally and overstay your visa, and so, but I'm thinking it's closer to 8, but it may be near 11. I don't have the exact numbers.
But I think this is, you know, this is an enormous number of people who, you know, the country and the legal system need clarity, need to figure out what is our stance here, what do we want to do? The Trump administration and actually the Trump campaign, you know, President Trump, when he was running for office, campaigned very vigorously on, you know, cracking down tighter border security. I think there's a little bit of a misnomer, though. I would separate conceptually border security from illegal immigration or undocumented worker status. Those are two kind of separate things. And as a public opinion guy, what I would point out to you is that on border security, Americans tend to be pretty hard line. That is, they want to protect the borders. They think it's, first of all, it's a matter of rule of law, but also, you know, we have these laws in place that are designed to reward certain kinds of people and behaviors, and, you know, allowing people to jump the queue is, you know, is something that we don't think is a good idea, majority anyway. So there's border security, but there's another aspect to the immigration issue, and that is, what do we do with people who are here? And on that issue, most Americans actually prefer, you know, the liberal or the Democratic point of view, which is, and actually some Republicans hold this position as well, we need to figure out a pathway to citizenship. How, you know, there's not much appetite for deporting, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 million people who are here illegally, but what do we do? And most Americans think, well, you know, if you have some sort of demonstration of loyalty, maybe pay back taxes, you know, take classes, swear your allegiance to the United States, or do some sort of service, then, you know, they're willing to grant citizenship status or some sort of temporary status. That a pathway to citizenship is something that has a broad amount of support. So the Republicans kind of have the upper hand with respect to public opinion on border security, but the Democrats have the upper hand when it comes to what to do with people who are here illegally, right? And so there are these two separate issues. Now, what's going on right now is that the executive, as you know, the president is in charge of enforcing the laws of the country, generally, and in this particular case is in charge of enforcing immigration laws. And so the issue that's erupted over the past couple of weeks is the decision by immigration authorities to separate people who are here illegal, families that are here illegally, separate some children from their parents. All right. Now, and that might be kind of mystifying to you. Why would you do this? What sense does this make? And I'm certainly not here to justify it, but the explanation is that what's happened is that the United States has developed a reputation, the border security and immigration authorities have developed a reputation that is known in other countries, that they will not separate families. So if you come over with a child, they will treat you differently. And in particular, they will process claims to political asylum, which is a way that if you're here illegally, if you come across the border, you don't have the proper documents, and you're nabbed by Immigration Naturalization Services, if you have a child and you claim that you are seeking asylum, either for because your government and your home country is persecuting you, or even something as simple as domestic abuse, right, that you go into a separate sort of category and processing process, right? So there are incentives to bring children over and there are incentives to claim political asylum because you're treated differently. And the response of immigration authorities in the United States recently has been, well, we're going to separate and process those children from their parents, separate them from their parents. Well, you guys have probably seen the visuals on this. And it is, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking and heart-rending. So, you know, the response to this particular policy has been quite negative. And in fact, there's a rush in Congress now to deal with this particular aspect, like, you know, we should make this, you know, end this particular response, right? Don't let authorities separate parents from children. And then there's a broader movement now, let's get immigration reform done. But it's a tricky issue politically. Republicans in particular are kind of torn on the issue. A lot of the conservative Republicans want to be kind of hardcore on both border security and rule of law when applied to undocumented workers. And so they're afraid, you know, that this is a position that's going to hurt them. Democrats are a little less, I think, torn on the issue. They would like to see immigration reform, but they're not unhappy to see Republicans twist in the wind and to see the fallout, political fallout probably from some of these, you know, really tough pictures. So, President McDaniel, you're a public policy guy, immigration bona fide is. What do you think?
So first of all, thank you to Philip Moniz, who helped us out. It's actually 12 million undocumented. And actually, one of the arguments been put forward about why you have this boom in the undocumented population is because the U.S. used to have somewhat of an open border where people go back and forth for work. But when they close off the border, these people can no longer go back, and so they're kind of stuck. And so there's this argument that these hardline immigration laws have actually increased the number of the undocumented, the number of undocumented immigrants, because they cannot go back and return as they were able to in the past. And this has really been something that's been on the table for more than a decade. So during President Bush's presidency, he tried to deal with immigration, could not get anything done. President Obama is trying to deal with it, and now we have President Trump. And you know, one of the things about this is people are asking, well, why can the president get away with this? Why is the president allowed to do this? Is we also need to remember that President Obama actually exerted a great deal of executive privilege in terms of how he was going to handle the immigration laws. And so what you're seeing is that the growth of the power of the president that you saw kind of during President Bush and also during President Obama, that President Trump is taking advantage of this. And so it is a story about immigration, but it's also a story about executive privilege and really the amount of power that the executive branch has. And we're seeing that grow more and more over time. And again, it's important to remember that when President Obama was in the Senate, he complained about the amount of power that President Bush had. When President Trump, when President Trump was running for office, he complained about the amount of power President Obama had. Now that when they have it, they're not really going to relinquish it, and they're going to, if any way, try to see it grow. What we should expect to see is Congress kind of coming in and trying to actively curtail the power of the executive branch. And it'll be interesting to see how the relationship between Congress and the president goes forward, given the things we've seen coming out of the Obama administration, but also the Trump administration.
It's a great point by Professor McDaniel. In fact, it leads nicely into the video segment we'd like to run to close out this particular issue area of discussion. So if we could run that real quick.
To start with that battle at the border, the firestorm growing over children being separated from their parents, sparking protests around the country now.
Nearly 2,000 children taken from their parents, accused of illegally crossing over a six-week period. Images like this one you see right there is getting a lot of reaction this morning.
And Michael, as you know, President Trump is now heading to Capitol Hill tomorrow to discuss immigration with Republicans. But this morning, First Lady Melania Trump is already weighing in on what she's seeing. And former First Lady Laura Bush now calling the policy cruel overnight. Our senior White House correspondent Cecilia Vega has much more for us this morning. Good morning, Cecilia.
Hey, David, good morning to you. You know, this is a policy that is now just eating away in terms of controversy at this White House. And now in the middle of all this controversy, a rare intervention from two first ladies who normally are not weighing in on policy matters. Let's go right to First Lady Melania Trump's statement released through a spokeswoman. She says, quote, Mrs. Trump hates to see the children separated from their families and hopes both sides of the aisle can finally come together to achieve successful immigration reform. She believes we need to be a country that follows all laws, but also a country that governs with heart. Now, this both sides line really seems to be echoing the president's claim that Democrats are to blame for this. Of course, the president's critics say he could unilaterally stop this essentially with a phone call and bring this policy to an end. I want to go now to Mrs. Bush's comment. She is comparing these detention centers to World War II era Japanese American internment camps. Quote, I live in a border state. I appreciate the need to enforce and protect our international boundaries, but this zero tolerance policy is cruel. It is immoral, and it breaks my heart. David, you know this. This is a growing chorus of opposition from Republicans to the president's own allies in the evangelical community, too.
And, Cecilia, you make a good point there. So what does the president hope to accomplish when he goes to Capitol Hill? Does he want this zero-tolerance policy stopped, or is he okay with what he's seeing, these children being separated?
Well, he really caused mass confusion on Capitol Hill last week when he seemed to dismiss the Republican compromise, compromise on immigration. The White House had to clarify, saying that it's actually the Democratic bill that he is opposed to. So this trip to tomorrow is really about rallying Republicans on the Hill over this issue that has vexed them for years. You know, the president said he doesn't want to see these images. But again, David, his critics say he could stop this himself.
All right, Cecilia Vega, I know you'll have much more on World News tonight.
I like that trash truck going behind her at the White House. It reminds me of trying to get to class on Speedway here these days. But you saw exactly what Professor McDaniel was talking about there, which is the Congress is in charge of the laws. The Congress has passed immigration laws, but the president is in charge of interpreting and enforcing those laws. And, you know, a few years back, President Obama basically said they were going to back way off in enforcing a lot of these immigration laws and, you know, the great, you know, bit on Saturday Night Live questioning, you know, where they sort of said like, wow, the president has that authority. Well, unless the Congress steps up and does something about it, then presidents tend to get away with really shaping and interpreting these laws. If the Congress wants clarity, the Congress has to pass laws. And in fact, I think Ted Cruz introduced a law basically ending the sort of separation of families that we've seen in the last few weeks. That has not passed, but it's been introduced. And so by the time you guys see this, maybe we'll have some resolution on that.
Yeah, it's going to be something that drags out a bit. And I think President Trump saying that it's Congress's fault is a little bit of an overstatement because, I mean, he has a lot of executive privilege. But also he's taking advantage of a Congress that for some reason seems inept in order to get things done. President Obama got frustrated with it, so he started doing executive orders. President Trump realizes, okay, you're not getting anything done. Well, I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing. You may hate it, but you all can't work together to stop me. So I think President Obama realized that, and I think President Trump realized that as well. And that's why, if you want to understand why the president seems to be able to do these things unchecked, is because the legislative branch, for some strange reason, cannot get its act together.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we've been emphasizing the primacy of the Congress with respect to the Constitution, right? Article 1, longest section, the most, you know, dedicated powers clearly going to the Congress. But, you know, what we've seen since World War II, certainly, and maybe even accelerated in recent years, is if the Congress doesn't act and there's a vacuum, the president tends to step in. And is that constitutional? Is that the way we're supposed to do it? Well, probably not. But somebody's got to step in, and if Congress doesn't use its power, you know, presidents have that opportunity. So there's four other issues we want to talk about today. We wanted to hit the Inspector General's report on the Clinton email scandal. We'll try to bring some clarity on that. Want to talk about a partisan gerrymandering case that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically punted on it. We also want to talk about Professor McDaniel's favorite thing, rank-ordered voting. All right, so say a few words about that. And we also want to talk about an interesting article in the New York Times this last week about affirmative action hurting certain kinds of students, maybe not the students you would think who are hurt by affirmative action. So let's start, hit them in kind of rapid sequence. I want to talk about the Inspector General's report on the Clinton email investigation. So this is an issue that's hanging around from 2016, where when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she was faced a lot of scrutiny, a lot of tough questions, because she used a so-called homebrew server, as well as personal emails to conduct official State Department business. And there was an investigation by the FBI into this. Now the FBI's investigation is the subject of an investigation. This is consequential not only because of the initial question, which is, you know, communications and the sanctity of communications for people who are serving in the executive branch. You know, what sort of transparency, what sorts of privacy issues are there? What do we do with someone who does something that they're not supposed to do when it comes to communication? All right, so that's the initial issue, right? But in the investigation, what became clear with the Inspector General's, you know, report was that members of the FBI who were investigating the Clinton email controversy, you know, seemed like they had political agendas, had political biases, didn't pursue leads. All of this stuff was sort of came out in the IG report. So we wanted to get distill this as much as possible because there's a lot of controversy about what is and what is not in the Inspector General's report. So we actually prepared a quick and dirty little set of bullet points for you. So if we could put those up on the screen, we'll kind of walk through those real quickly. Here's, as far as we're concerned, everything you need to know about the report. The IG's report, IG meaning Inspector General, found no evidence of political bias. So the FBI prosecutors who were considering, should they take action in 2016 against Hillary Clinton for her use of a homebrew server and her use of a private email to conduct official business. They said that, well, the FBI people who were involved in that, they did not appear to be affected by bias. Now, let me be quite clear. It doesn't say they weren't biased. What it said is there was no evidence that their decisions about what to do with Hillary's situation were affected by bias. Okay, so in fact, there were all sorts of interesting emails by people involved about how much they hated Trump, but they couldn't find any evidence in the IG's report that the FBI's attitude, posture, behavior towards Secretary Clinton was affected by bias. Second bullet point here, the FBI's actions. The Inspector General said they were ultimately, even though they didn't find direct evidence of bias, cast a cloud over the Bureau and senior damage and did lasting damage to the FBI's reputation. This gets back to Professor McDaniel and I were talking about this before class. You know, the FBI is supposed to be the ultimate, you know, kind of element of civil service in the United States, that they are beholden to a set of rules and norms that are, they're not partisan, that they're, you know, they're subject to evidence and expertise, and they're supposed to be the very best of the bureaucracy in some ways. You know, they're not touched by bias. Because, you know, I was thinking about the, you know, the old movie The Untouchables with Kevin Costner. You know, these people who aren't subject to, you know, the mob or Al Capone's influence, right? They're the best of the best. And when you've got email exchanges back and forth between FBI agents saying, you know, we're going to take Trump down and stuff like this, that hurts the image of the FBI, and it adds to this cloud of mistrust that hangs not only over the political branches of government in the United States, but now to our civil service. So a third bullet point we wanted to mention, the text messages. And these were between the ones that are really kind of attract a lot of attention between this FBI lawyer, Lisa Page, and I think it's Peter Strzok. Strzok, I think that's how you pronounce it. They were, as we say in political science, lovers. And so there's a lot of emails back and forth between them. And in a message on August 8, 2016, Page said, Trump's never going to become president, right? Right? And Strzok replies, no, he's not. We'll stop it. So these things came out. And actually, this third bullet point is really what they're talking about in bullet point two. In other words, these are the things that are really damaging. It doesn't seem that there's evidence that any of these people acted on these sort of anti-Trump impulses, but they sent these messages, and they sent them out over, you know, their FBI emails. And that's the kind of thing that really does damage. And if you're a Trump supporter and you look at that, you go, you know, really? That's the FBI? They're supposed to be investigating, you know, the secretary's use of emails and a homebrew server and, you know, their reluctance to investigate her aggressively. How could it not have been influenced by their political views? So even though there's no direct evidence, that kind of stuff hurts the perception about the FBI's behavior in this whole thing. And then the last two bullet points we wanted to mention real quickly, the Clinton meeting with Loretta Lynch. This was, and you guys probably don't remember this, but in the summer of 2016, Loretta Lynch was on an airplane in Phoenix. Bill Clinton happened to be on the tarmac at the same time. Why Bill Clinton's hanging out at a tarmac in Phoenix, I'm not quite sure. If you've been to Phoenix in the summer, you know it's 150 degrees, but you know, Bill's Bill. And Bill actually boarded her, this is the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch. Bill Clinton boarded her plane at the same time the FBI was investigating his wife, former Secretary of State. And so that contact meant that Loretta Lynch had to ultimately recuse herself from the case. And that was something that should not have happened and, again, kind of contributed to this icky feeling about the whole thing. And then finally, our favorite guy, James Comey, his personal email. The report found that Comey used a personal Gmail account, ironically, given that the whole the subject of the investigation was Hillary Clinton's personal email. He used this for official government business when he was FBI director. So Comey doesn't come across well in any of these sorts of things. So these are kind of the main finding of the inspector general's report. There was no evidence that bias affected the way they treated the Clinton case, but there's all this kind of unprofessional, I think you term it, behavior on the part of the FBI agents that created, this odd cloud of suspicion around the whole thing. So that's all we want to say about that. Professor McDaniel, any observations? Or
It was also important to note that they actually said that Comey was insubordinate, in fact, he should never have said anything publicly at all. But then also, one of the things the FBI has been trying to overcome is the legacy from J. Edgar Hoover, who used the FBI to basically bully whoever he wanted to. So they don't want that image anymore, and something like this actually hurts. But also to kind of humanize them, not necessarily defend them, but to humanize them. If you can think of anybody, if you work anywhere, you have an idea of who you want your next boss to be. If you know a new boss is coming in, you can be like, well, is Sheila going to be boss? Because, Sheila kind of crazy. I think we'll lobby for Karen. We see this going on, but when it happens within the FBI, where you're supposed to be impartial, this becomes extremely problematic, and it means that the justice system is just as political as anything else, which means, well, what can we really believe is fair and just in American society?
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. As Professor McDaniel says, these are basically a lot of people were sort of saying, well, we think Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president, and I don't know, does it really make sense to go after her aggressively? In this investigation. And what the IG's report said was that they could not find any evidence that either political bias or professional bias influenced their decision to take kind of a non-aggressive posture towards the Clinton email investigation. You just can't help but look at all this stuff and go, well, there may not be direct evidence, but, and on the other hand, Democrats were furious and remain furious that Comey, continued to sort of talk about the email situation publicly and say things like, that Clinton behaved, I don't think he used, well, wasn't it was, reckless.
It was not illegal, but recklessly, or not criminal, but recklessly,
right.
I believe, yeah.
And that kind of language, and there are a lot of Democrats who believe to this day that election was swung by Comey's last press conference, which occurred in late October, in which he said, well, she's not guilty of anything, but, just continue to raise this Clinton email issue. And again, the IG's report said that all of these press conferences that Comey did were not standard operating procedure. It didn't say they were wrong. It just said that's not the way the Bureau typically works, which obviously can be read as sort of an indictment of that. So a couple other issues. I'll take gerrymandering if Professor McDaniel will take rank ordered voting. Just a real quick version. We thought there was going to be a big decision on partisan gerrymandering. Now, we haven't gotten to gerrymandering in the course modules yet, but it's essentially when you draw, after every 10 years, there's a census of the United States. The next one will be in 2020. And the census determines how many representatives the states get into the Congress, and even if there is no reapportionment, that is, if the number of representatives that your state gets doesn't go up or down, even if it's the same number, you have to redraw the lines. That's redistricting after the census. Gerrymandering is when you draw the lines in a way to maximize something, right? You can have a racial gerrymander where you're trying to maximize one group's representation at the expense of another. You can have partisan gerrymandering where you're maximizing Republicans at the expense of Democrats or vice versa. So that's gerrymandering. By the way, Seth Maskett, a colleague of mine who went to UCLA a couple years after I did, he's on a one-person crusade because Elbridge Gerry, who is the namesake of gerrymandering, his name is being mispronounced. That his name was pronounced Gary, and yet we say gerrymandering. I'm really such a nerd; it's unbelievable. But at any rate, nobody's lobbying for gerrymandering. There were two big cases, big protests, legal suits brought against two states that wound their way up to the Supreme Court last week. One from Maryland, where the Republicans were contesting what they considered a Democratic gerrymander, and one in Wisconsin, where the Democrats were contesting what they considered a Republican gerrymander. The core argument is that these were partisan gerrymanders. So these weren't race gerrymanders or any of those. Partisan gerrymanders. And the court, the Supreme Court, has historically not been terribly interested in adjudicating on partisan gerrymanders because the Constitution clearly lays out that the state legislatures are in charge of determining the districts, right? And so the court has been kind of, you know, they don't really want to get too involved in that, right? But these cases wound their way up. In fact, we have a short video from The Hill, which is a Washington website, does a lot of good political reporting, and it kind of explains some of the particulars of the Maryland and the Wisconsin case, if we could cue that up.
The Supreme Court on Monday ruled narrowly against a group of Democratic voters in Wisconsin who challenged their state's redistricting map as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. The court said the residents lacked standing to bring the case forward and remanded the case back down to the lower court to give the voters an opportunity to prove they were injured by the maps, which were drawn by Republican legislators. The case, Gill versus Whitford, stems from a challenge Democratic voters brought against the redistricting of legislative districts. They argue Republican officials unfairly and strategically put them at a disadvantage.
Okay, so that's sort of the bare bones of the decision. What's fascinating here, and the court's done this a lot lately, the court said the plaintiffs in the case, the people who said, hey, this gerrymander is, you know, unconstitutional, the court said those plaintiffs don't have standing. Now, this is something that you have to have. You have to actually, to bring a lawsuit, you have to actually demonstrate that you were irreparably damaged by the law or the action. And what the court said, what the Supreme Court said, is that they gave the voters who were involved in the suits, both in the case of Maryland and the case of Wisconsin, opportunities to show how they were irreparably damaged by the lines, and they never really did that. So in other words, they did not have standing to bring the suit. The court took a complete pass on the issue of, you know, standards by which they would judge whether a partisan, you know, drawing of lines was too much. As I said, the court doesn't really want to get into that too much, but there are questions about, you know, can you basically disenfranchise a group, sort of marginalize them such that they don't have any shot at electing somebody, even though they represent a considerable portion of a state or an area? These are interesting questions, but the court took a pass on them. They basically said, and this is an interesting question, right, which is there any such thing as standing in a case involving a partisan gerrymander? You know, let's just say I'm a Republican in Travis County, and, you know, the lines are drawn in such a way that I can never hope to elect a Republican representative. And you could draw the lines to include me in the Hill Country in Williamson County in a way that I could help elect a Republican. But exactly what's the harm done to me in having a Democratic representative under those circumstances? I'm interested in this decision, even though it allowed the court basically to sidestep, you know, gerrymandering. So, Professor McDaniel, any thoughts on the lack of a gerrymandering decision here?
I think the standing thing is very important, because if you allow the court say we must recognize partisanship, I guess, as a criteria, then what other criteria come into play as well? And so you may be opening up basically a can of worms that you can't control. I think in many ways the court took a stand. It was like, look, unless you can prove that this does harm you, can clearly show that this harms you, you really can't do anything. We know with racial gerrymandering that there is clear harm. I mean, the South is a perfect example of that. But this,
yeah,
can you really demonstrate that? Now, one thing that many states have done to really avoid this is that they've actually gone to nonpartisan committees to draw the districts. And a lot of states are making this push where you take it out of control of the legislature and you put it in within a nonpartisan committee, with the idea being that these nonpartisan committees will draw fair districts.
Yeah, that's happened in a number of places. Texas, actually, after the 2000 census and redistricting mandate, set up a three-person commission, two Republicans, one Democrat, and one of the Republicans, Bill Ratliff, who's a very prominent Republican back in the 80s and 90s, sort of sided with the Democrats. And so one of the reasons that the Republicans redrew the redrawn lines in 2004 was that they were unsatisfied with this commission that the state legislature had in fact set up. The state legislature can kind of do this however they want. They can draw the lines themselves.
Yeah.
They can punt over to a special committee, you know, but so it's the state legislatures that have the right to do this. And I think that's kind of what the Supreme Court's wants to be a little hands off about. You know, the Constitution says the state legislatures can figure this out. And so you got to have a pretty high standard for the Supreme Court to weigh in and knock out, you know, the decision of the duly elected branch of whatever state we're talking about. So, at any rate, not much movement there. Could you explain to us a little bit about rank order voting, though?
All right, so rank
order. That's been in the news.
So rank order voting, I think many people, when you go to vote, you cast a vote for either one person and you move on. Rank order voting means that you have, let's say there are three or four people on the ballot, you rank them, so 1 through 5. And the idea is that the person with the lowest vote total gets taken out to the next round, and so their votes, so let's say number 5, everybody who ranked the 5th highest vote getter number 1, well, that person's taken out, so the person they ranked number 2 now becomes their number 1 vote, and so on and so forth, until you kind of wind it down to to one individual winner. Now, what's important to note is that there are a bunch of different voting styles that are out there. So we're used to the single member plurality system, and there are multiple others. There's cumulative voting, where you walk in, you're given 3 votes. You can either bundle your votes for one person, or you can spread them out over others. There are multiple voting methods. And this rank order voting is kind of something that people have been pushing. However, and one of the things that people do like about it is that it allows, if you have a very strong, intense feeling for somebody, you can help them. And in many ways, this actually helps to create a multi-party system. However, there are some concerns that it might be undemocratic, specifically when you're just voting for one individual, where a small group of individuals with very intense preferences can kind of take over the election for governor or some other office. A lot of people have really championed rank ordered voting in regards to voting for a legislature, where you're seating multiple individuals. And so the idea is that the intensity of a certain preference will not take over the legislature, but will make sure these groups are represented. And so it's really going to be interesting to see how this goes forward, specifically when you're looking for one individual as opposed to a body of individuals. And again, this is not something new. There are numerous types of voting methods that are out there, and we need to kind of be aware of these various voting methods, but the fact that they all come with their positives and negatives.
Yeah, this is something we wanted to introduce this week because there was an election last week in Maine. Sort of two elements of this ranked voting, ranked choice voting came up. The first was that Maine reaffirmed their support. There was a referendum on whether Maine would continue to use ranked choice voting as their main mechanism for selecting candidates statewide and for their legislative races. And Maine reaffirmed that. And then, as you know, since Maine was using it, they also had rank ordered voting for their state legislative elections. And there were some interesting results. San Francisco also uses rank order voting for their mayoral elections. And as Professor McDaniel was saying, the interesting thing about rank ordered voting is, and it, you know, you think, I guess let's kind of give you guys a big point, a takeaway point. Institutions and rules of the game matter, right? This is something we want to emphasize throughout this semester. And the way in which we conduct elections influences outcomes in the United States. I mean, you know, ask Hillary Clinton with respect to the Electoral College, right? The rules of the game have a big impact on the outcomes that we get. So why the heck are we talking about ranked choice voting other than, you know, they had some stuff in Maine last week? Well, there are a lot of people who think that if you went to ranked choice voting, what you'd get is you'd get majority winners. So there, another word for ranked choice voting is an instant runoff. Because what happens is, let's take Texas. You know, you've got Republican, Democrat, let's say a Green Party candidate and a Libertarian Party candidate. And let's say in the first round, the Libertarian gets 5% of the vote, which is the lowest vote total. Well, that person, that candidate would be eliminated, and that candidate's supporters would, their second choice would kick in. So their candidate's eliminated, and you default to their second choice. So let's just say the Libertarians, you know, as their second choice, preferred the Republican. Well, those votes would go to the Republican, and the vote would be recalculated. And let's say now it's the Green Party candidate who's the low person, and that person's eliminated. Well, that person's supporters, their second choice kicks in, and the votes are reallocated. Let's say those go to the Democrat, right? And you keep doing that until somebody gets 50%. That's what we mean by an instant runoff. So if you have all of that information present in a single vote, you don't have to have, like we have in Texas, you know, an election and then 6 weeks later a runoff election. And the claim on the part of advocates of this system is that there's two claims. The first is it's more democratic. That's the argument. It allows people to take into account. So I can vote for my third or fourth or fifth party candidate, and still influence the outcome, ultimate outcome of the election, that my preferences aren't wasted, right? So that's a strong kind of reason that people advocate for this. They like the fact that you get a majority winner. That's what they mean by it's more democratic. And they also think, and this is sort of a more tortured argument, but that it would limit the impact of money. And I think the argument runs roughly along the lines of, you know, that the two dominant candidates in terms of money, people tend to be attracted to them because they know the other candidates don't really have a chance. And so it actually reinforces or exaggerates the influence of money in American elections. The funny thing is that if you look at some of these recent results in Maine and in San Francisco, there's no evidence that having a ranked choice system advantages less well-known or less affluent candidates. In fact, the candidates with the most money won every one of the races that we're talking about under ranked choice voting. So I'm not sure how much of a, you know, how much of a positive that is as kind of one of these consequences of ranked choice voting. Maybe it would be, but anyway. So, but we just wanted to point this out because, you know, when you watch a show, whether it's, you know, American Idol or The Voice or these shows, we want to draw you into our nerdy world. And our nerdy world always kind of looks at, man, that's a terrible, like an American Idol, for instance, what's the mechanism for selecting who advances? Well, you eliminate the person with the lowest votes. Well, that means somebody with a small committed, you know, core of voters, of supporters, is going to advance week after week after week, maybe long after they probably should have been eliminated. You know, let's say there's somebody who 10% loves and 90% hates. That person's going to be around a while because their 10% is going to rank them first. Let's say on the other side, there's somebody who is the second choice of everybody. Well, they could be eliminated in round number one, right, because they got no first place votes. Right, so it's, you know, again, kind of a nerdy observation with respect to American Idol, but all these shows and contests that we see in American culture and American sports, they all involve rules, and the rules do matter. And one of the things we want to emphasize is you have to think through these rules and figure out what are the consequences when you set your game up. Politics is a big game. We have rules. Rules matter. So finally, we want to end with a brief discussion of affirmative action policy. Affirmative action is something that both Professor McDaniel and I talked about in the context of interest groups. And there was an interesting story in the New York Times last week about the consequences of affirmative action at Harvard. Now, Professor McDaniel and I love to take shots at Harvard. We didn't go to Harvard, couldn't have afforded to, didn't get in, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Hopefully most of you are with us on this.
Boston's, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not heartbroken I didn't go to Harvard, let me put it that way. But Harvard has had took some real shots in this New York Times article with respect to how they've been conducting their admissions policies lately. And if we could, we've got the actual excerpt from the New York Times article up on the screen, right? So this is, as it turns out, I mentioned that there's a little bit of a, you know, something that might surprise you a bit, and that is that affirmative action policy at Harvard doesn't seem to have helped African-American enrollment all that much. It doesn't seem to have helped Latino or Hispanic enrollment all that much. What it seems to have done is hurt Asian-Americans. So take a look at this article excerpt. Harvard consistently rated Asian-American applicants lower than any other rates on race on personal traits, right? So this is a criteria they use at Harvard, like, quote, positive personality, likability, courage, kindness, and being, quote, widely respected, unquote, according to analysis of more than 160,000 student records filed Friday in federal court in Boston by a group representing Asian American students in a lawsuit against the university. All right, so you see, it goes on to say that Asian Americans scored higher than other racial or ethnic groups on all these admission scores, all these objective criteria, but that the subjective criteria, the holistic criteria that Harvard uses for admissions processes, they were consistently and apparently systematically downgraded, right? So the concluding quote here is, it turns out that the suspicions of Asian American alumni, students, and applicants were right all along. This is the group Students for Fair Admissions said in a court document laying out the analysis. Harvard today engages in the same kind of discrimination and stereotyping that it used to justify quotas on Jewish applicants in the 1920s and 1930s. So, you know, we've talked about affirmative action in the context of jobs, but we've also talked about it in the context of admissions to colleges. And, you know, again, what we set up in that discussion was the idea that, you know, the rights of the individuals on the one hand, you know, so in this case, you know, a student who does really well on a test but is not admitted, to the school. And the school's argument is that, yeah, you individually were hurt, but that's because we're serving a larger purpose. We're trying to help this group that has been systematically disadvantaged, right? That this is a trade-off that we're always talking about in American politics, right? The rights of the individual versus the rights of the collective or the group. And this is a constant tension in the American system. But what happens in the case here, like where, it's not just individuals that are hurt, but it seems systematically that one group is disadvantaged, and we're not even quite sure who is benefiting here. It seems that, there's this sort of, I think it turns out that whites tend to do a little better because Asians are downgraded in the Harvard admissions process, but it's not like African-American or Latino admissions at Harvard are through the roof during this period of time. It seems that they're not comfortable with what they would get with an objective rendering of their own statistics, which is something like, 50% to 60% Asian American enrollment. So I don't know that I have any cosmic significance to attribute to this sort of thing, but it's just sort of interesting. And I don't even know that I kind of do blame Harvard. It's fun to take shots at Harvard. But I've seen the same thing at my home institution, UCLA, where there's been an effort over time to deal with admissions. And I think the affirmative action policies generally, Professor McDaniel is much more of an expert on this kind of stuff than I am. He's actually studied it. But one of the things that's interesting is that since in California, you're not allowed to use race as a criteria. So what they end up using in a lot of admissions are other variables that are, in my opinion, just sort of reading the data, weakly correlated with race. And you end up getting an odd admissions policy. So in California, for instance, they take into account socioeconomic circumstance and, home and lifestyle things, all of which I think are consequential and important, but they're not strongly, powerfully correlated with race. And so, for instance, in the case of Asian Americans, there are a lot of Asian Americans who end up with personal circumstances that are much, they're, tough. Is tough or tougher than, Hispanic or African-American students, but that's not actually the group that the university necessarily wants to benefit. So it's complicated, but I thought this article was interesting. By the way, this is a lawsuit. This is a claim against Harvard. So the stats are the stats, but I don't want you to take this as the Bible on this, right? Harvard has another point of view about what they're doing and how they're doing it. So.
Yeah, and part of this also fits into this larger narrative that Asian Americans have been trying to fight against for a long period of time, of specifically that of being the other. So there's a lot of work which talks about how Asian Americans have never really been fully accepted as American. And so they've constantly been trying to fight. It's like, no, we've been here. They're constantly asked, well, where are you from? Or where are your parents from? It's like, San Francisco, where are your parents from? San Francisco, where are your grandparents from? San Jose. I mean, it's and so there's constantly being question is, are you do you really belong here? And in addition to this, you've also seen a great deal of backlash against really Asian Americans doing well in school. You've seen this at UCLA, you've seen this at other schools. And so this idea that Asian Americans don't have the proper traits or personality traits for Harvard in many ways fits with the stereotype of this group is, they're nice, but there's something wrong with them. And they're not like us. And this has been something that Asian Americans have been fighting for centuries. If you think of the Chinese Exclusion Act, think of the Japanese internment camps, or even the idea of being considered the model minority, it's this idea of, they're the other and they'll never fully assimilate. And so this is a problem that, all the Ivy Leagues have had to deal with this, whether it be deal with race, anti-Semitism, things of that nature. It's something that never really seems to go away. And as we try to create a much more equal society, we, in many ways, have to acknowledge some of the biases that we have and try to confront them head on, with the idea being that if you confront them, you're openly aware of them, that you can prevent them from being problems in the future.
Yeah, I think, anytime you're setting up a criteria, again, the theme of the day, I guess, is that rules matter. And, you think about it from a college admissions point of view, and you say, well, okay, we've got GPA and test scores, and then we want to take into account these extant circumstances, your home, your environment, how tough you had it. We certainly don't want those people who are less advantaged to, suffer. And what I think, they found at these places is that if you go by those sets of criteria, that Asian Americans end up being at the very top of that list. And then you're in Harvard's situation, like, whoa, well, my gosh, that would be a class of 60% Asian Americans. So rather than say we don't want that, which I think would be more intellectually honest, but certainly illegal, these holistic criteria are brought in, and you have an embarrassing situation like Harvard is facing now, where you've downgraded on these subjective criteria that, you know, clearly I think are basically sort of, you know, discriminatory grades or marks that are being given. But they're the only means by which Harvard can kind of create a class that sort of fits its interpretation of what would, you know, what it wants a Harvard class to look like. Again, you know, we like pointing out the imperfections in the system, but we also want to really try to give you guys a little bit of context and circumstance. I mean, I don't think Harvard is just evil. I don't think it's quite the same as the sort of intentional discrimination to keep Jewish populations down in the 1920s and 30s, although there's clearly a case you could be made on those lines. I think they're trying to do the right thing, but they've got kind of crude mechanisms to do it, and you end up with very clumsy efforts like this sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, trying to create diversity is very difficult, and it has become one of the questions of should universities be actively trying to create diversity? Many universities know that is our goal, but what do you consider to be diverse? Do you consider economic diversity, racial diversity? What do you consider to be diverse? And defining that has been very difficult, and universities are really the front lines where you're seeing a lot of these fights for how do we make sure everybody has access, everybody who's qualified has access to these things, to these same tools.
Yeah. So with that, I think we're done for the week. Guys, have a great week, and we will see you same time next week. Talk to you all later.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.